This is Hugh Liney for the City of Sydney, and today we're going to take you on the Rock and Roll Walk of Fame and Shame through Surry Hills and Darlinghurst to King's Cross. In the street opposite the Devonshire Street exit from Central Station in Surry Hills is both the Gaelic Club and the Strawberry Hills Hotel, which was formerly the Southern Cross. Now, in the daytime, Devonshire Street has always been a pleasant tree-lined boulevard for local workers. But at night, it's near empty, almost abandoned some nights, and it's a darkly suitable gateway to the nighttime theatrics of Surry Hills. The Gaelic Club remains a major venue for local and international bands. Up the road on Chalmers Street for many years was the Musos Club or Musicians Club, sometimes a mix, often a direct clash of cultures really between established musos and more naive but artful new wave exponents. On the corner of Elizabeth Street is the Strawberry Hill, as we said. It sits directly on top of the historic Sydney Tank Stream. Wandering drinkers can see it downstairs and smell it from anywhere. The hotel has seen as much musical change as any venue in the area. It was often a house for trad jazz or more experimental music forms and piano-playing Dick Hughes, who also we often see pounding the keys at the nearby Shakespeare Hotel. The Strawberry was previously known as the Southern Cross. Now, in a gloriously minimalist period of low production values and high energy, the Southern Cross was a home during the late 70s and early 80s to a barrage of garage bands, thrash fiends, and some middle-class punk bands who'd actually hardly ever played a note in Suburban Anger before. The venue capacity was about 80 comfortably, but on a night when there was a minimum of 150 jumping fans, no gig in Sydney was as noisy or sweaty, as great or as lousy as the Southern Cross was. All types of sunny boys, gurus, celibate rifles, all helped train themselves there. Bruce Griffiths is the head, in fact the only honcho, of Aberrant Records. He spent some great nights at the Southern Cross.
The most memorable night for me, which I'm not sure of the year, would be the Gun Club. I believe they needed to make up some extra money. They lost some money somewhere or something. So they organised this last-minute show at the... what was probably then the Strawberry Hill. And it was... I don't know if it was advertised. It could have just been word of mouth. You have never seen so many people packed into this venue. Absolutely crammed for a brilliant Gun Club show.
Now, if you choose to stroll down Elizabeth Street, that's north, then you'll pass the remaining facade of the Evening Star, or the Evil Star, the hotel where musos and journos drank and talked and drank more, and Kurt Cobain and Dave Grohl of Nirvana played pool and the jukebox in the background when they toured. But look, trekking up Favreau Street, past the perennial all-styles Welcome Excelsior Hotel, one can take in the memories of the very important Trade Union Club. Now, along with the also no longer remaining Graphic Arts Club near Central in Chippendale, the Trade Union Club featured mostly the cream, occasionally just the froth, of the Australian independent music scene. The Laughing Clowns, the Go-Betweens, Nick Cave and the Birthday Party, Died Pretty. From overseas, there were dozens of legendary performances throughout the 80s, really, by peaking artists such as the Dead Kennedys, the Violent Femmes and the great John Cale. Bruce Griffiths was there for the Dead Kennedys and others.
The Dead Kennedys, two nights in a row, the walls were quite literally dripping with perspiration. That is not an exaggeration. The walls were wet. It was they were absolutely amazing. I also remember, bizarrely, Box of Fish were meant to be headlining there, but they got a last-minute phone call from the record company of Real Life, the New Romantic, I guess, band. And so Box of Fish got their headline pulled, but they were paid, I think, more money to support Real Life in this venue that was not really a Real Life venue. And what I distinctly remember was a friend of mine in Send Me an Angel, a friend of mine had the Box of Fish drum cymbals. And every time... they sing Send Me an Angel and there's a big cymbal crash, She ran from the back of the Trade Union Club down the front, smashed the box of fish symbols together on the symbol crash, then ran back up the back.
Both the Graphic Arts Club and the Trade Union Club were part of another good social trend that helped revive ailing trade union and artisan clubs around Central and introduce new cash and, you know, plus some odd-looking new clientele into their vast club rooms. On the corner of Fitzroy and Bourke Street is the boarded-up Hopetown Hotel. In its best times, some people call it the Hoey, the Hopetown was one of the most vibrant, casual and fun-filled music gigs in the city, I suppose. Hoodoo Guru guitarist Brad Shepherd remembers a few interesting points about the Hopetown introduced by some of his colleagues.
Wasn't that concept James Baker's? Rock against work?
I think it probably was. It seems
very James, and I remember him articulating this concept to me maybe a year before it actually eventuated. I'm pretty sure that he initiated the very first Rock Against Work. It is a very James Baker concept.
Now, will the Hopetown make a rock and roll comeback as it has several times before? Well, perhaps the inexorable gentrification or yuppification of Surrey Hills makes it difficult for music venues to boom like they used to in decades past. Noise, fire and licensing laws are all patrolled properly these days, which is no bad thing. New venues are beginning to open up again. They're just different. The carpet doesn't stick. The bathrooms don't stink. The staff are polite. And it's all smoke-free. But is it rock and roll? In a previous rock and roll walk of fame and shame, we've explored the darkest depths and the musical highlights of Darlinghurst and Oxford Street, including Radio Birdman at the Oxford Tavern, the missing links at the greatest venue with the worst name, Beetle Village, and wine bars such as Witty's for the folkies, and a lot more. But slightly off route, but very much worth visiting in Darlow, is the Stanley Palmer Culture Centre, or Culture Palace, the scene of many political, cultural and sometimes even artistic happenings over the past decades of quiet revolution and youthful dissent. The Stanley Palmer Culture Palace remains, as a curio, on the corner, yes, of Stanley and Palmer Streets, off Lower Crown Street near the Italian Cafe area. At 171 William Street was the studios of 2 Double J and briefly Triple J, worthy of an entire social history profile in itself, I reckon. And just above in St Peter's Lane was the Sydney Filmmakers Co-op, a veritable hotbed of revolutionary hotheads who saw film as their, albeit government-funded, outlet on social issues. Members included Philip Adams, Albie Toms, Phil Noyson, later even Peter Weir and Gillian Armstrong. Up the road in Forbes Street, just a little bit, is the St Peter's Church Hall, where Johnny O'Keefe and his production team rehearsed performers and auditioned hopeful audience members for hours on end for the live-to-air 6 o'clock rock TV show. In the southern end of Darlinghurst Road, where the Jewish War Memorial now stands, was the Maccabean Hall, where the psychedelic delights of LSD Fogg's light shows could be experienced with the ethereal music of Tamim Shad or Galadriel sometimes. And it's all downhill from here to King's Cross.
She comes off like a rose, and everybody knows she'll get you in Dodge. Well, you can look, but you better not. Poison Ivy.
At the top of the cross, underneath the Coca-Cola sign, which is one of the few symbols of continuing permanence, however less grand it now appears. Anyway, it's always a good place to start a stroll down remaining memory lane, as we've described it. On the corner of Darlinghurst Road and Victoria was the converted King's Cross Cinema, which in the early 60s was a surf, stomp, beaten, rock and pop venue called Surf City, run by promoter John Harrigan. Now, pop life at Surf City is very fondly detailed in the book Sex and Thugs and Rock and Roll by Billy Thorpe, who joined the Surf City house band The Aztecs, who obviously became very famous with Billy, and with other acts such as the Sunsets, the Atlantics, the Easy Beats, and Little Paddy. They made the venue an alcohol-free teen favourite. Peter Cox of the Powerhouse Museum also leads walking tours around some of King's Cross's top venues.
And Surf City had kind of music that was becoming popular in that 63-64 period, just before the kind of British invasion, when there was that explosion of surf music, instrumentally, and the Del Tones and all that. So you got bands playing that. Little Paddy played there on the first night at Oakland, you know. You know, the Beach Boys were in Sydney in January of 64. Even they dropped into Surf City.
Down William Street, just a bit with this entrance tucked round in Broome Street, is the legendary jazz venue El Rocco. So called as its basement location is carved out of rock. Now, in its 60s heyday, the early careers of local jazz legends Errol Buddle, Col Nolan, John Sangster and Bernie McGann were alongside some early Kiwis we also now call our own, like Judy Bailey and Mike Nock. There were visiting jazz greats, and they included Dizzy Gillespie. Further down William Street was Whiskey A Go-Go, much more glamorous than Surf City, and with the magic piece of paper that helped make rock and roll so attractive to business persons, and that was a liquor licence. Rock Garden was a later incarnation on this site. Now, from the top of the cross, walking around the corner into Bayswater Road, we first passed the freshly renovated Hampton Court Hotel, where the resident band in the 70s, AC/DC, wrote and most probably got the Jack, a groupie homage that still figures in the band shows, though presumably not in their lives. Across the street is New World Bar, which has regularly undergone style transformations throughout the years, and many identities too. Remember the Cardoma Cafe, Sgt. Pepper's, Candy's, all names of this cellar venue where Mick Jagger once performed while promoting his enormously average solo career. If you walk northeast down Darlinghurst Road, in the daytime we suggest, you pass McDonald's, which was once breakfast venue Sweethearts to Cole Chisel and songwriter Don Walker. Up near the El Alamein Fountain, on the right near the Bourbon and Beefsteak, at 26 to 28 Darlinghurst Road, was the Folk Attic, or later called the Folk Terrace, which was very innocent in its early 60s pipe dreams with peace and politics and Peter, Paul and Mary lookalikes, but it built very good local folk performers nonetheless. Trevor Lucas from Fairport Convention was a local boy, well, from Melbourne really. Jean de Swan and Bob Hudson, for instance, were performers there. Beyond the El Alamein Fountain, as Maclay Street starts, was the Rex Hotel. If you dared to enter and still come out with lungs, liver or face unbruised, then you may have also heard the truly great Max Merritt and the Meteors. A walk westwards down Orwell Street off Maclay is essential. You get to the Deco Majesty of the Metro Theatre, and next door its architectural buddy building with its semicircular roof adornment, which was most famously the Roosevelt Club from World War II and many years after. Now, this was a classy joint based on a sophisticated imitation of Hollywood glamour nightclubs. The Roosevelt originally started as an officers' club and featured Sydney society at its finest, mixed with sly grog. But stylish dance floors and music ensembles featuring budding band leaders and impeccable instrumentalists such as the great Les Welch, one of Australia's true recording and performance legends. The Metro Theatre itself, once the Minerva, was sometimes a movie house for MGM, sometimes a live theatre. Lord Olivier and Vivian Leigh appeared on stage there. But it became most famous for its 1969 season of Hair, the musical that proves to the adult world that the youth of the day could sing and dance as well as just take their clothes off. Along Springfield Avenue was the Mansell Room, later creatively called Springfield's. But the Mansell was popular for very few reasons. The atmosphere was dank, the carpet stuck, the air stunk, the compulsory food was undeniably the hardest in town to keep down, and the bands were often as whacked as the audience. Former record company executive and King's Cross arts identity John Moyle recalls the Mansell Room very strongly.
Okay, well, Sammy Gaha, who was known as Little Sammy, did the music, and Joe ran the club. But Joe was a Mancunian Jew who had ran clubs in Manchester and came here, saw an opportunity. Sammy was a working musician. This was like a venue where Sammy could work as a bass from. And Joe took over the club, and he came up with the idea of the Mansell Room. Now, Mansell didn't mean anything. It was actually called the Mansell Curry House originally. The food at the Mansell Room came about because of the draconian licensing laws, which meant that only restaurants could serve alcohol late at night. So as you went into the Mansell Room, you got a pink food ticket. And in honour of this food that was served on a paper plate, and was usually something like spaghetti bolognese or something very quick and easy to prepare, there was a great piece of graffiti in the toilet, which was, "Please flush twice, as it's a long way to the kitchen." But the heyday of the Mansell Room really was, I guess, the late 70s, early 80s, when bands like Matt Finish really made their name there. Baby Animals started out showcasing their act there. And the Mansell Room was really the place in Sydney to play. And so you had bands like the Treble Clefs, who I managed, who their ambition was to play the Mansell Room, and then it had its importance in Sydney to the point where when Men at Work left Australia to go to the States, just as they were breaking out, they did a showcase gig at the Mansell, and so would a lot of other bands.
Gee, it was fun though. One of the few really late night clubs that gave the average punter at least a chance to gain entry into its low light, low budget delights. The Mansell gave many bands the opportunity to learn to perform long and late, and gave the audience equal experience in staying up, you know, all night sometimes with only a little help from their friends. The Chevron Hilton and its Silver Spade Room was ostensibly the finest upmarket nightclub for grown-up Sydney in the 60s and 70s. The Chevron actually opened in 1960 and was demolished in 85 after a brief new life as a mod rock venue. But audiences could wine, dine and be entertained by the finest, the very finest the wider world of entertainment could provide. Ella Fitzgerald, Shirley Bassey, Sammy Davis Jr. would do the honours, while Sydney socialites lapped up the fine fare and the true international celebrity status of the Chevron. Peter Cox of the Powerhouse reminds us of some of the Cross's most famous visitors from 1964.
Of course, another port of call if you're looking at sites of the Cross in relation to music is the Sheraton Hotel, where the Beatles stayed during their visit in 1964. You know, the promoters tried to book the Beatles into the Chevron, which wouldn't have them because they didn't want crowds of screaming fans outside on the footpath outside the Chevron. Well, the Sheraton is across the road from the Chevron, and so there were crowds of screaming fans there anyway. And the Sheraton was very kind of sort of modern, dazzlingly modern in 1964, and the Beatles had the whole top floor penthouse. And of course, they arrived on that very wet and cold June morning and went straight there, and their clothes were all wet. The capes they'd got in Hong Kong on their way through were soaking wet, and their luggage was still in transit, so George appeared on the balcony wearing a towel. Of course, this was the site of what Lennon later revealed in an interview with Jan Renner to be the, you know, when he talked of the Australian tour in terms of satiricon scenes. And, you know, there was an seemingly endless supply of girls who were only too willing to, you know, meet the Beatles.
The Sheraton thrust narrowly upwards, plain and still unadorned, not unlike it was in 64 when the Beatles waved from the balconies. George was in a towel only. The Sheraton is now called Azure Apartments. Hopefully future developers will also just let it be. Other venues around the Cross worthy of a walk past include the artist hangout The Yellow House at 59 Macleay Street. It's the Yellow Building. The Guest House and Bar to the Stars, the Siebel in Ward Avenue. The greatest ever modern era nightclub, Arthur's in Victoria Street, just along from the Piccadilly Hotel. Itself the home to many nightclubs of quite some exclusivity and always evolving character. Long gone is Benny's, the music industry spiv hangout, or the Paradise Jazz Cellar in Darlinghurst Road, and the great Lee Gordon's Sound Lounge. and it is literally downhill from here if walkers choose to visit the site of perhaps the strangest and greatest venue that Sydney ever fabricated or prefabricated, the old tin shed itself, the Sydney Stadium. The stadium, in all its revolving and revolting glory, played host to the Lee Gordon era of the 50s and 60s and welcomed the first true mass stars of popular music, like Frank Sinatra, Johnny Ray, Bill Haley, Buddy Holly and, of course, the Beatles, plus the new Aussie thrusters like Johnny O'Keefe, all going round and round and round on that revolving stage like a record fell. If you do walk down the bottom of Bayswater Road or Craig End Street and avoid the 8 lanes of traffic and hop a fence, there's several concrete railway stanchions and a plaque that seems to remember a former New South Wales government minister called Ken Boo, but not a word about the famous or even the infamous from the world of rock and roll. Perhaps some New South Wales politicians should well remember the slogan for this series of rock and roll podcasts and urban walks. Remember the fame, because the shame lasts forever. Thank you for listening to our podcast version of the Rock and Roll Walk of Fame and Shame for Surry Hills through to King's Cross. The series was produced by Frank Cotterill, Ashley Russell and Hugh Liney for GTI Media and presented by the City of Sydney. The producers wish to thank the many famous and infamous contributors who are listed in the accompanying map and notes for their recollections and their record collections. These productions celebrate the popular music history and the exciting cultural diversity of the City of Sydney.